We're going to take a look now at allegations in the Kimry article concerning long-standing contacts between George Bush and Theodore George Ted Shackley, a longtime CIA operative, the head of the JM Wave station in Miami that was deeply involved with the CIA's anti-Castro efforts. And, of course, Theodore Shackley was deeply involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. Anthony Kimry writes in this particular story, after relating George Bush's denial, saying that the White House, quote, won't give dignity to this matter with any additional comments, President Bush settled this in 1988 with his denial. Kimry goes on to say, that's pretty much the sort of imperious denial Bush gave to the recurring and unanswered questions about his role in the Iran-Contra mess. In that case, too, the apparent Bush-CIA connections go back decades. There is evidence that prior to Bush's appointment as DCI in 1976, he was well acquainted with legendary spook Theodore George, quote, Ted, unquote, Shackley, who joined the agency in 1951. When Bush arrived on the scene at Langley, it was clear to longtime agency insiders that there was a real bond between these two men that went back many years. Between 1974 and 1976, a sensitive period in U.S.-Chinese relations, Bush was ambassador in Beijing, and Shackley was chief of the CIA's Far East Division. In 1976, shortly after he became DCI without seeking advice, Bush promoted Shackley to Associate Deputy Director of Operations. In this position, he was second in command to the DDO, the third most powerful position in the CIA and one of the most pivotal in the entire government. Aside from their agency connection, already cemented during Bush's previous tenure in Beijing, it is hard to explain how the two men developed such a close bond. For the previous 10 years, Shackley was chief of station in Vientiane and Saigon, overseeing dozens of covert operations related to the Vietnam War. Before that, from 1952 to 59 and again during 1965 and 6, he worked in Germany. In 1962, before going into the jungles of Indochina, he returned for a 3-year stint stateside as station chief in Miami, then the largest CIA station in the world and the base of operations for the agency's vast paramilitary operations against Castro following the Bay of Pigs disaster. Quote, you've got old George Baby helping the company's operation against Castro, and here's Shackley in charge of the Miami station that's running the show. Now how do you think they know each other, my friend, unquote, mused a former CIA operative involved in the anti-Castro activities. Again quoting, theirs was a damn close relationship. Still is. Under Bush's tenure at DCI at the CIA, the two men worked together. Shackley oversaw Central American operations and established the infrastructure for the Reagan White House's adventures a short time later. The veteran agent was not only the catalyst for the notion of selling arms to Iran to free the hostages, but he was also one of the architects of, quote, low-intensity conflict, unquote, the new name for the CIA's covert strategy in Central America. Shackley was eventually forced out of the agency in 1979 when an arms sales scandal involving him finally exploded. His relationship with Bush continued, and shorn of official CIA status, Shackley reemerged in the early 1980s as an integral player in Iran-Contra. Throughout the early stages of these operations, Bush reportedly met with Shackley at Shackley's office in downtown Arlington. Now, let's take a couple of minutes here and take a look at the coincidence between the careers of George Bush and Theodore Shackley. First of all, George Bush was, according to a number of anecdotal accounts presented in this particular article earlier, George Bush was alleged by former CIA operatives involved with the anti-Castro effort to have been involved in lending support to that effort using Zapata Offshore Oil in a number of different capacities. In this same time period, Theodore Shackley was head of JM Wave, the Miami CIA station, which was the hub of the CIA's anti-Castro efforts. Bush also went on to become U.S. ambassador to China at the same time that Theodore Shackley was chief of the CIA's Far East Division. Now, when Bush became director of Central Intelligence, Shackley became associate deputy director of operations, very much involved with one of the central figures in covert operations around the world. Now, when George Bush went on to become vice president. Theodore Shackley was formerly, quote, an ex-agent, but in fact, the concept of an ex-agent is a very dubious one, and certainly both George Bush, there is abundant evidence that George Bush was, in fact, his denials to the contrary, notwithstanding, deeply involved with the operations of the Iran-Contra scandal, and Theodore Shackley was certainly involved with those operations. So the assertions by many CIA veterans, anonymous here, that in fact Bush and Shackley were well acquainted because Bush had been working for CIA for a long time, those certainly merit serious consideration because obviously there is a considerable degree of coincidence between the operations of both men's careers. The last section of this particular story that we're going to look at is appropriately titled Skeletons in the Closet. It deals with George Bush being appointed Director of Central Intelligence. By the way, of course, he was appointed Director of Central Intelligence by Gerald Ford, himself a former member of the Warren Commission. I would also note that one thing not mentioned in this particular article is that George Bush was made head of the Republican National Committee during the Watergate crisis. Gerald Ford, among the many people who was involved not only in one aspect or another of the cover-up of the assassination of President Kennedy, but also obviously involved in Watergate. In an addendum to the Guns of November Part 3 done some weeks back, I developed more fully the numerous connections between the John Kennedy assassination, and Watergate. Now, this next section is entitled Skeletons in the Closet, and it reads as follows. Without question, President Gerald Ford's nomination of Bush to head the CIA was a departure from precedent which some members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and their staffs greeted with suspicion. The public objection was that Bush was a partisan politician who would politicize the office. The objection whispered behind closed doors by those who had heard that Zapata had been an agency cover during the days of the CIA's anti-Castro exploits was that Bush was an agent with a past to hide. A man with skeletons in his closet might be a dangerous choice to guard the nation's own collection of loudly rattling bones. The Church Committee and Watergate had already cracked open the CIA door too far for some and exposed the relationship of the Watergate burglars to the agency's anti-Castro activities, including several assassination attempts on Castro. Perhaps, however, some of Bush's supporters thought that someone who had successfully concealed his own past might be the perfect person for the job. The appointment of Bush as Director of Central Intelligence also coincided with the Senate Intelligence Committee probe of Oswald's and Jack Ruby's connections to Cuba, the CIA, and the mob. With his own ties to those operations, Bush was now in charge of what the CIA would and wouldn't divulge. I would also interject here. In 1976, the House Select Committee on Assassinations was formed to investigate the assassinations of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. Bush was in the driver's seat for CIA at this time as well. Continuing. As DCI, as Director of Central Intelligence, Bush frustrated committee investigators' requests for specific information in the agency's files on Oswald and Ruby and downplayed revelations about CIA involvement. Memoranda written by Bush on the Intelligence Committee's investigation of Oswald's and Ruby's links to the CIA and organized crime show he was especially interested in the committee's probing not only of what the CIA knew about the events in Dallas and didn't report to the Warren Commission, but to what extent, if any, the agency was complicit in Kennedy's murder. Clearly, as Director of Central Intelligence, Bush knew the agency had hidden and was still hiding crucial information which contradicted the Warren Commission's verdict. Yet in the wake of the furor over the movie JFK, Bush commented, quote, I have seen no evidence that has given me any reason to believe the Warren Commission was wrong, unquote. And in an interesting footnote to this particular section, from CIA memos and documents released under the Freedom of Information Act, that's the information presented, one aspect of Bush's interest in Congress's probe of Ruby may have been the fact that Bush was backed financially and politically in his 1970 congressional campaign by Murray W., quote, Dusty, unquote, Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R, then Secretary Treasurer of the Teamsters, according to an October 13, 1970 memo from Charles Colson to H.R. Haldeman, which was among Nixon's secret files released in 1987. Prior to that, Miller served Jimmy Hoffa in the South throughout the early 1960s as head of the Teamsters Southern Region Conference. Shortly before President Kennedy was assassinated, Ruby placed calls to Miller, which is interesting. I did not know prior to reading this article about the Miller-Bush connection, but it's an interesting one, and it may indeed help to explain the interest of or the activities of George Bush in limiting the disclosures that the CIA gave to Congress. Bear in mind now, George Bush has documented connections to George de Morenshield, an individual who was involved in handling the Oswalds, and an individual that we're going to be looking at in a big, big way in a few minutes. Also, another thing that's interesting and to note here, again, apparently, the key Teamster operative, Murray Dusty Miller, who had served Hoff in the South and was head of the Teamsters Southern Region Conference, was connected to Jack Ruby in some way. I would note, and this may be completely irrelevant, but on the other hand, it might be only too relevant, that the individual who owned the building in which Jack Ruby's Carousel Club was housed was a member, a director, I should say, of Zapata Oil. Another thing I would note, and this is certainly speculative, but in 1991, the Kennedy family had a lot of bad press when William Kennedy Smith was accused of having raped a woman. I noted in a discussion of the facts of the situation that it was extremely doubtful that William Kennedy Smith had raped Patricia Bowman. Among the things which argue loudly for his innocence and for perjury on the part of Patricia Bowman was the fact that, according to the police report, Patricia Bowman had driven to the Kennedy estate in Palm Beach. Supposedly she'd been raped. She then left, came back, and called a woman named Ann Mercer to come pick her up. That seems extremely unlikely to me that Patricia Bowman would have been raped, left in her own car, and then come back to the scene of the alleged crime to be picked up. I would note that Ann Mercer, according to the police report, had been seen arguing with Ted Kennedy in the nightclub at which the parties met earlier in the evening. Also, her father had been involved, had been convicted of fraud and perjury in a Teamsters pension fund scam. I would also note that Ann Mercer's sister had a house within a few hundred feet of the Kennedy estate within easy surveillance distance. The publicity surrounding Patricia Bowman's alleged rape by William Kennedy Smith, and it appears extremely doubtful that she was raped, not only caused the polls concerning Ted Kennedy to drop, his popularity dropped, but by extension, John Kennedy's popularity, his esteem in the eyes of the public, dropped as well. One of the things that I ask about this supposed rape of Patricia Bowman by William Kennedy Smith was whether perhaps this was a setup. One of the things that I have spoken about over the years was the fact that that American politics are governed by what are known as the four B's: bullets, bribes, bids, and blackmail. And the circumstances surrounding the alleged rape of Patricia Bowman suggest the distinct possibility that this may have been some kind of an intelligence scam. I would note too in this regard that at the recent Democratic convention in New York, none other than Gloria Steinem, herself an individual with a background in the Central Intelligence Agency, was trafficking around the poor victim or alleged victim, Patricia Bowman. That certainly didn't do the Democrats any good, and I think there's some very serious questions to be asked about that. Now, taking a couple of minutes here to sum up what we've looked at so far, there appears to be strong circumstantial evidence suggesting that George Bush has, in fact, been involved with the CIA for a long time. We've taken a look at possible networking involving Yale University. His father, Prescott Sr., also himself a former intelligence officer, was not only a major benefactor of Yale, was a close friend of William Casey, who became director of Central Intelligence under Ronald Reagan. Casey obviously was involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. There are firm indications that Bush was. And I would also note that Casey was director of the campaign for Ronald Reagan and George Bush. It was William Neal Mallon, an associate of, among others, Prescott Sr. and Alan Dulles, a key CIA operative and director for many years, that put Bush in contact with IDECO, a subsidiary of Dresser Industries, frequently used as a cover for CIA operations. The same Henry Neal Mallon put Bush in touch with Oswald Handler and probable U.S. intelligence operative George de Morenshield, himself an individual with a very, very interesting background and a handler of Lee Harvey Oswald. We've also looked at allegations concerning Bush's possible involvement or apparent involvement in the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban efforts, using apparently Zapata offshore oil as a cover for some of these activities. We also took a look at Bush's activities in seeing to it that U.S. Petroleum companies had access to Mexican oil. Among the other people involved in this was George de Morenshield working for Brown and Root, something we'll take a look at in a few minutes. We also took a look at the apparent involvement of George Bush, that's George Herbert Walker Bush, in engaging the reaction of the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban, the Cuban exile community in Miami to the assassination of John Kennedy. We took a look at the coincidence between the careers of George Bush and Theodore Shackley. And we also took a look, lastly, at the appointment of George Bush by former Warren Commission member Gerald Ford to head up the CIA at a key point in which Congress was looking into, among other things, the information that the CIA had on Oswald and Ruby. And again, bear in mind that de Morenshield and Bush, introduced by Henry Mallon, were obviously connected, both appear to have worked in the petroleum industry and to have used their petroleum industry activities as a cover for intelligence activities. And bear in mind that George Bush was involved in frustrating congressional probes into the CIA files on Oswald and Ruby. And again, bear in mind that the person who owned the building in which Ruby's Carousel Club was housed was a director of Zapata Oil. Now, the point that we're making here, and again, Ruby and Bush had Dusty Miller, a key Teamsters official, in common. Of course, the Teamsters loathed the Kennedy brothers. Robert Kennedy was deeply involved in prosecuting or attempting to prosecute Jimmy Hoffa and the syndicate-connected Teamsters. That didn't win him many friends or win the Kennedys many friends. Now, the point of this present discussion is to take a look at George Bush and the political forces of which he is a part and with which he has been operating. We're going to take a musical break. Now, when we come back, we're going to take a look at George de Morenshield, nay, George von Morenshield, an associate of George Bush, probable associate in the, certain associate in the petroleum industry, probable intelligence associate, and possible handler of George Bush. He was certainly, de Morenshield, that is, one of the handlers of Lee Harvey Oswald, because we're going to take a look at the milieu of which de Morenshield and Bush were part. We're going to take a look at their involvement with the assassination of President Kennedy, and this by way of understanding the nature of this political milieu, this petroleum industry, intelligence, and as we shall see, Galen organization, ABN milieu. And this, again, by way of understanding the nature of the forces that are in control of the country today. A musical break, and then we're going to take a look at George de Morenshield, the petroleum industry, the intelligence community, the assassination of President Kennedy, the Galen organization, and some extremely, extremely unsavory elements, but elements which, unfortunately, we're going to have to let sit upon our palate if we are to understand our current political situation. Music, and then more of tonight's prepared portion. We're going to continue now with the prepared portion of tonight's program. We have been looking at George Bush, his tenure as CIA director, and affirm indications that, in fact, George Bush has been working for the CIA for quite some time. Not definite, but probable. And beyond that, we're going to be taking a look at George Bush, at George Bush's relationship with George de Morenshield, one of the Oswald family's handlers in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. What we're going to be taking a look at now is the intersection between the petroleum industry, which is one of the main bases for the relationship between Bush and de Morenshield and the intelligence community, and it appears probable that Bush and de Morenshield were working together in the intelligence community. And beyond that, there are a number of connections between George Bush and the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy, and it is quite possible that George Bush himself was involved in covering up the assassination of John Kennedy as director of Central Intelligence. One of the questions that I think needs to be asked is whether or not Bush himself, who appears to have been involved with the CIA's anti-Castro milieu, that milieu was certainly involved in Kennedy's assassination. One of the questions I think we need to ask is whether or not perhaps Bush himself might have been involved in some way in the assassination. Whether or not he was, it appears probable that he was involved. He certainly was instrumental in frustrating congressional probes into what the CIA knew about Oswald and Ruby. And we're going to take a look now at the milieu of which George Bush was part and the nature of the political milieu which took this country over on November 22nd, 1963, because that milieu was explicitly fascist. And we're going to take a look now at connections between the petroleum industry, in particular independent oil operators. We're going to take a look at the relationship between that and the U.S. intelligence agencies, the CIA in particular, and also elements associated with the Galen organization. That was the organization of Nazi Major General Reinhard Galen. It was the Eastern Front Intelligence Organization for the Third Reich during World War II, and it jumped to the CIA after World War II, became in effect the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. It then became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and when West Germany was incorporated in 1956, it became the intelligence service for the Federal Republic of Germany. Now, the reason we're going into this is to understand the nature of the political forces which were ascendant or have been ascendant since November 22, 1963. The reason why it is important to study history, to study the past, is so that we can understand the present, and when we understand the present, we can reasonably understand the future. In the early part of the prepared portion of tonight's program, I talked about the probability that major commercial banks will be going belly up, possibly after the election, or the announcement of that will come after the election. I think we need to ask ourselves very carefully how a political milieu of the type that we are looking at now, Bush was certainly part of that milieu, whether or not he was involved with the Kennedy assassination. I think we need to ask ourselves how a milieu like this will react to the extreme social dislocation which would be produced by a financial collapse. We're going to begin now by taking a look at a very important document, unfortunately an unpublished document. This particular monograph is entitled Government Documents and the JFK Assassination. It is authored by the brilliant Berkeley researcher, Dr. Peter Dale Scott. And we're going to take a look now at the relationship between the petroleum industry, the intelligence community, and some of the Eastern European and Soviet emigre who worked with U.S. intelligence and came to U.S. intelligence by way of the Galen organization and related institutions. Peter Dale Scott writes in Government Documents in the JFK Assassination, speaking of the Kennedy assassination, there is also, for example, the CIA to be considered. As mentioned before, Mamontov and Gregory, that's Ilya Mamontov and Peter Gregory, two of the White Russian handlers of the Oswalds in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, beginning again. As mentioned before, Mamontov and Gregory had collaborated in 1955 to set up a Dallas parish of the CIA-subsidized Russian Orthodox Church outside Russia, a parish restricted to aristocratic anti-Bolshevik Russians who had been, quote, checked, rechecked, and double-checked, unquote, by the CIA-subsidized Tolstoy Foundation. Members of this tiny anti-Bolshevik parish of, quote, maybe 25 families, unquote, at least eight of whom were connected, like Mamontov and Gregory, with the oil exploration business, acted very much in the manner of intelligence case officers in providing, quote, babysitting, unquote, services for the Oswald family when they arrived in Texas. The exotic oil man and Baron George de Morenshield in particular would cheerfully drive the Oswalds to other oil men's parties and swimming pools and once spent all day loading his car down to the ground when Marina wanted to move. De Morenshield told the Warren Commission that during World War II he worked for French intelligence. He thus concealed that during the war he was a suspected German agent who admitted having worked for a year with movie producer Baron Konstantin Maydell, M-A-Y-D-E-L-L, whom he described as, quote, not a spy but pro-German, unquote. Today it is known that Maydell was for a period the top German Abwehr agent in North America. Abwehr, by the way, was German military intelligence during the war, spelled A-B-W-E-H-R. Continuing. Reinhard von Galen, who in the post-war era was in charge of the CIA's Russian emigre programs, is said to have recruited veterans of Maydell's Abwehr Group 2 and to have worked with East European emigre organizations inside the United States. I mention this because Oswald was met on his return to America from Russia by spas, tea, Raikin, R-A-I-K-I-N, then ex-secretary general of one such group, the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. Raikin's AFABN, like the Galen Network and some of its CIA sponsors, was bitterly opposed to Kennedy's moves in 1963 towards rapprochement with the Soviet Union. Before we resume with Peter Dale Scott's manuscript, it should be noted that in the Guns of November number 4, we talked about de Morenschild having been detained for on suspicion that he was spying on the Aransas Pass Coast Guard station during World War II. Now, in the Kimmery article, it said that de Morenschild was part of a network that Alan Dulles ran inside the Third Reich. I have never seen that anywhere else before. As far as I know, de Morenschild was never formally charged with spying for the Third Reich. It is possible that upon his interrogation after being detained for suspicions of spying on Aransas Pass, he was turned. This is common intelligence methodology, but it is a matter of public record, again, that he was associated with Baron Konstantin Meidel, in charge for a time of all Abwehr activities in North America. It is also apparent that whether or not he was turned, he was spying for the Third Reich. We're going to turn very briefly to the book High Treason, subtitled The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, What Really Happened. This was co-authored by Robert J. Groden, G-R-O-D-E-N, and Harrison Edward Livingston. This book was published in softcover by the Conservatory Press, and it is copyrighted 1989. And of de Morenschild, and this shortly after his alleged suicide, when he was going to be interviewed by the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1977, Groden and Livingston write, de Morenschild's wife told Jim Mars, a Dallas reporter, quote, He must have still harbored guilt feelings about his work for the Germans during World War II because he told me, quote, it's the Jews. They have caught up with me, unquote. During the war, de Morenschild had been briefly detained on suspicion of being a German spy. Nothing further was heard on this until his wife spoke to Mars. So whether or not he was turned after being detained in connection with Aransas Pass, he certainly was a German spy at one point and fit in very nicely with the Galen ABN milieu that we're looking at. By the way, I would emphasize that as we looked at in a miscellaneous archive show entitled Nazis and Anti-Semites on the Bush Campaign, in 1988 on the Republican Ethnic Heritage Council, many of these same Galen ABN-related elements were known to have been working for the Bush campaign. Unfortunately, this story did not get the press that it deserved. I would note that among the fascist collaborators and sympathizers on the Bush campaign was a fellow named Laszlo Pastor, a veteran of the Hungarian Arrow Cross organization, the Hungarian fascist organization that worked with Hitler. He had later turned up as the director of Eastern European activities for the Free Congress Foundation, founded by Paul Weyrich. This organization was very close to Boris Yeltsin in the former Soviet Union. The breakup of the Soviet Union into its constituent ethnic republics was one of the major goals of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. If we don't have time for it this evening, we will get back to ABN connections to the assassination of President Kennedy later. Continuing here with Peter Dale Scott's manuscript, and again, government documents and the JFK assassination, Scott writes, many, if not all, of the international oil companies themselves maintain their own private intelligence networks, which collaborate all over the world not only with the CIA, but with the emigre organizations subsidized by the CIA and von Galen. And at home in the United States, quote, the American Petroleum Institute has encouraged its member companies to sponsor reserve officer units among their employees, unquote. That a quote from Robert Engler's The Politics of Oil. Continuing, this brings us back to Army Intelligence Reserve Officer Jack Alston Crichton, C-R-I-C-H-T-O-N, the oil man who recruited Mamontov as Marina's interpreter and who in 1963 was an API delegate behind the Iron Curtain. I would add that Mamontov and Peter Gregory were instrumental in distorting Marina's testimony. Bear in mind that Marina Oswald spoke no English. She was a refugee from the Soviet Union, and they distorted Marina's testimony in such a way, and this is a matter of public record, as to incriminate her husband. By the way, I would interject briefly, Lee Harvey Oswald was almost certainly a U.S. intelligence operative given a left cover, fingered for the assassination, and then murdered before he had a chance to exonerate himself. It is important to study the Kennedy assassination, as I said, to understand the nature of the political forces at work. I don't have much regard for what I have previously referred to as the Grassy Knoll Brigade. It's important for the uninitiated to familiarize themselves with the facts of the Kennedy assassination, including the physical evidence, but the entire Warren Commission thesis is absolutely ridiculous. I don't think it makes any difference at this point in time who the three tramps were or exactly how many bullets were fired. What is important is to understand the political forces at work so we can understand the nature of the political realities which are upon us today, and indeed a study of history, a study of the past, is vital for an understanding of the future, our understanding of the present, so that we can anticipate the future. Now again, take a look here at the relationship between the petroleum industry and the intelligence community. We looked at that in the Kimry article about George Bush. Obviously, Bush associate DeMorenshield was a key part of this. George Bush was certainly part of it, and this is the milieu that we're looking at, a milieu which involved George Bush, currently President of the United States. Continuing with Scott's manuscript, however, DeMorenshield's past intelligence activities may have been less relevant than his post-war career as an oil exploration geologist like Gregory, Mamontov, and Crichton. The extensive plumbing by the Warren Commission of his overseas travels and intelligence work for oil companies revealed the extent to which this was a secretive and closely knit profession with CIA overlaps, and also that the emigre Russians of St. Nicholas and other similar CIA-subsidized parishes played a role in it, analogous to the role later played in worldwide CIA activities by emigre Cubans. Asked about a Russian emigre oil financial expert in Connecticut with the Chase Manhattan Bank and his connections with the Dallas Russian community, DeMorenshield replied, quote, "We all knew him, because there are so few people in this geological field," unquote. DeGolyer and McNaughton, by the way, that's capital D-E, capital G-O-L-Y-E-R, and capital M-A-C, capital N-A-U-G-H-T-O-N, beginning again, DeGolyer and McNaughton, the Dallas-based firm with world preeminence in this profession, was closely linked to members of the Russian parish and others who took turns babysitting the Oswalds. Lewis McNaughton's personal accountant, the white Russian George Bouhe, B-O-U-H-E, was said to have been, quote, rather mad at Marina for taking an apartment at Oak Cliff because it was rather too far for him to drive and help her when she needed help with the baby. DeMorenshield, who took care of Marina's dentist bills and later lied about this to the FBI, apparently had McNaughton's son in his house as an, quote, associate and constant guest, unquote. Michael Payne, P-A-I-N-E, an ideological right-winger who went with Oswald to the suspect Dallas Civil Liberties Union, which the Dallas police and the 112th Military Intelligence Group both had under surveillance, had an uncle, Eric Schrader, S-C-H-R-O-E-D-E-R, who was a friend and investment associate of DeGolyer. His cousin Alexander Sandy Forbes, a former director of United Fruit, belonged to the Elite Trial, T-R-Y-A-L-L Golf Club retreat in Jamaica with former DeGolyer associate Paul Regorodsky, a financial patron of St. Nicholas Parish. Finally, Declan Ford, with his Russian wife took care of Marina after the assassination, had worked many years for DeGolyer and McNaughton, the former employers of Jack Alston Crichton. By the way, remember Crichton, we're going to come back to him later. It seems possible that behind these McNaughton associates' solicitude for the Oswalds was a less disinterested concern with Cuban oil. Before the fall of Batista, DeGolyer and McNaughton had been active exploring for oil in Cuba on behalf of a closely linked company which today, as Pan Oil, has Crichton as director. Oswald's chief chauffeur, Count George DeMorenshield, also explored for oil in Cuba at this time on behalf of the interlocking Cuban-Venezuelan Oil Voting Trust, a company which played heavy Cuban politics in order to obtain and protect its oil leases. One of its directors, Amadeo Barletta, B-A-R-L-E-T-T-A, the local representative of General Motors, was close to dictators Batista and Trujillo, as well as allegedly the international narcotics traffic. Another, J.M. Bosch Lamarck, B-O-S-C-H-L-A-M-A-R-Q-E, quote, was one of the first and earliest supporters of Castro, unquote, before turning against him in 1959. He was also Castro's chief contact with Jules Du Bois, a Chicago Tribune Castro publicist and alleged U.S. Army intelligence veteran who also played an important role in the 1954 CIA coup in Guatemala. So again, we are seeing many of these same handlers of the Oswalds in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, chiefly George DeMorenshield, an obvious associate of George Bush and possible intelligence handler of George Bush, deeply involved with Cuban oil. And recall in the Kimry article, we took a look at how the Cuban nationalization of its petroleum industry aroused a great deal of distress in the U.S. intelligence and petroleum circles. We're now going to flesh out the associations described by Peter Dale Scott in government documents and the JFK assassination. We're going to read a long section involving many of these same people and elements and giving more details about them. This is from the unpublished manuscript, The Dallas Conspiracy, also by Peter Dale Scott. The government documents and the JFK assassination is a companion manuscript to this. Now, some of the elements to keep an eye on in the section I'm about to read you. Keep an eye on DeGolyer and McNaughton, the Petroleum Geological Exploration Institute, many of whose members were instrumental in handling the Oswalds. Bear in mind, too, that the significance of looking at the Oswalds' handlers is to understand the political forces that were involved in destroying President Kennedy and which came to power as a result. Oswald himself didn't kill anybody. Note the name Isaac Don Levine, an individual who was trying to make it appear as though the Kennedy assassination had been performed by the Soviet Union. Isaac Don Levine was an ardent Cold Warrior, and before World War II, he had not only been instrumental in arranging contacts between J. Edgar Hoover and also a State Department official named Adolph Burley and Whitaker Chambers, who helped to frame Alger Hiss as an alleged Russian spy. And Alger Hiss had been the special counsel to the Nye-Vandenberg Committee, which had been investigating the links between U.S. munitions makers and the fascist powers of Europe. Isaac Don Levine also was instrumental in floating a bogus manuscript, which was called Out of the Night, allegedly by a Soviet agent named Jan Valtin. In fact, this particular document was authored by a Third Reich intelligence agent named Richard Krebs. We took a look at that in Radio Free America 15. Also take note of the organization NTS, or the Solidarists. That was a white Russian emigre organization which went to work first for the Third Reich and later for U.S. intelligence. Also, take note of some of the aerospace connections to the milieu we're going to be looking at, in particular the TFX scandal, which involved Bobby Baker, that could have destroyed the political career of Lyndon Johnson. The TFX fighter later became known as the F-111. Also, we're going to take a look at the Brown and Root Construction Company, which was instrumental not only in the rise of George Bush and Richard Nixon, that was mentioned in the Kimry article that we read earlier. Bear in mind that DeMorenshield worked for this organization, and as we shall see, Lyndon Baines Johnson was generously assisted in his political career by the people behind Brown and Root as well. I'm not going to interrupt for interpolative discussion here because this is largely a posit to the section that I just read you. It will flesh out the details more. But again, the interrelationship here between the intelligence community, the petroleum industry, and also through that, the elements associated with the Galen organization is one of the main things we want to look at. Continuing now with the Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. Scott writes, "The case that Oswald was an agent is strengthened by the paradoxical condition of poverty and privilege in which the Oswalds lived after their arrival in Texas. Though he severed all contact with his family after Thanksgiving 1962, and though he seems to have made not one single friend otherwise, Oswald and his wife Marina were now favored with the attentions of a small circle of wealthy Russians and their friends, connected almost exclusively with the politically influential petroleum engineering industry. The Warren Commission's list of 34 persons, quote, with whom Lee Harvey Oswald may have had contact, unquote, many of whom met Oswald for only a single evening, is striking testimony that Oswald's social life was entirely governed by his Russian patrons. Every single person on this list, as well as some others whom the commission did not include, had been met by the Oswalds through these patrons. This includes the alleged liberal Ruth Payne of the ACLU, who assumed the same babysitting role between mid-April 1963, the time of the Walker incident, we're going to take a look at the Walker incident later, and November 22, 1963, when relations between the Oswald family and the Russian community were temporarily suspended. This Russian community, by no accident, had links with wealth, petroleum, the political machines of both parties, government, and above all, intelligence activities. Take, for example, the first two people whom Oswald contacted allegedly in his search for someone in Fort Worth who spoke Russian. Of the two, the Russian-born Peter Gregory, a petroleum engineer, was a personal friend of Mike Howard, one of the two Secret Service agents who isolated Marina Oswald in the days after the assassination. We shall see that Howard used Gregory in his interrogations of Marina, and that Gregory abused this responsibility by significantly distorting what Marina said. The second person, Gregory's friend Mrs. Max Clark, a princess of the Sherbatov family, that's Sherbatov, was apparently the first Russian with whom Oswald made telephone contact. Yet she was not asked by the Warren Commission to testify. The significance of this initial contact was systematically denigrated in the report. And Mrs. Clark's name was even suppressed from the Commission's list of 34 possible Oswald contacts. This is hardly surprising. Oh, by the way, take note here, too, of Warren Commission Counsel Wesley Liebler, who was in charge with investigating the White Russian connections of Oswald, and whose investigation could be described as perhaps less than vigorous. Wesley Liebler was a partner in the law firm of Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn, one of the key foreign policy law firms of this country. I would note that Frank Wisner, former Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, who was in charge of the Office of Policy Coordination, which brought many of these same Galen-related Eastern European and Russian emigre elements into the United States, he was a senior partner at Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn, at the same time as William Harding Jackson, another senior partner in that same firm, was also another Deputy Director of Central Intelligence. Wesley Liebler worked for this firm. Again, the term networking here, I think, is operative, and I once again refer people to the book I mentioned earlier, The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch. Continuing here. Though Commission Counsel Wesley Liebler dexterously avoided bringing this fact out, Max Clark, who was on a first-name basis with the Fort Worth FBI agent who interviewed him, Earl Haley, was a former security officer for the Convair Division of General Dynamics, and he himself was, according to one witness, quote, in some way connected with the FBI, unquote. And Convair, up to the time of the Kennedy assassination, was being investigated by a Senate committee for possible major scandals surrounding the controversial contract award to build the TFX experimental fighter plane, again, that later became the F-111. It is important to recall that in the McClellan subcommittee hearings into the TFX contract award, the conduct of two men in particular had drawn public scrutiny. One was Roswell Gilpatrick, a GILPATRIC, Deputy Secretary of Defense, whose past and present contracts with General Dynamics seemed to indicate possible conflict of interest. The other was Fred Korth, who resigned as Navy Secretary in October of 1963 after a letter of his had been published showing abuse of his office's financial political alliance, abuse of his office. There's a page missing here. Ah, that's delightful. Anyway, let's see. Many of these same elements were involved in the financial political alliances behind Lyndon Johnson. Reynolds was, in fact, giving testimony in closed session about the Bobby Baker scandal, which threatened to terminate Lyndon Johnson's political career at the moment the assassination occurred. The Bobby Baker investigation, too, was deflected from such high-level implications after the assassination. Again, there's a page missing, so forgive my oversight under the circumstances. If the commission really wished to destroy a false impression that the assassination was a conspiracy, it should have investigated the links, however trivial, between Korth and the Oswald family. Korth, after all, had been present at the June 1963 meeting in which the president decided to visit Texas. One would therefore be interested to know whether Korth had any contact with the Oswalds in the years between 1948, when he was attorney for a Mr. Ekdahl, E-K-D-A-H-L, in his divorce from Mrs. Marguerite Oswald, and 1962, when he took over as Navy Secretary from his friend John Connally, then about to become governor of Texas, the responsibility for Oswald's, quote, dishonorable discharge, unquote. By the way, bear in mind that Lee Harvey Oswald had supposedly defected to the Soviet Union with top secret information about the U-2 project and America's radar defense networks, and then supposedly he comes back, is never prosecuted, and begins moving around in CIA anti-Castro Cuban milieu, and began hanging out with the ferociously anti-communist and many of them explicitly fascist white Russian community in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Hardly a credible situation. Continuing.